you can be proud of. Many times, being in a classroom, being in high school, or being in university, I hear a lot of the stereotypes that people set on refugees. People think that refugees are very specific type of people who come from a specific type of place. But the reality of it is, refugees can be just as dynamic as everyone else. And that we have the talent and the potential that it takes. But we're just unlucky enough to be born in a certain part of the world. And if we are giving the small amount of support and the little push that it takes, refugees are able to make incredible things happen. And so today, on World Refugee Day, I urge you all to be grateful and to take in the things that you surround yourself with. And to take a moment to think about all of the things that you have and how grateful you should be to be in a community that is so supportive. And to keep in mind that there are refugees all around the world who are struggling to see a future for themselves. It is an incredibly difficult and heart-shattering to be in a place where you have no idea what's in front of you. As a mother, you have no idea where your children are going to go. As a child, you have no idea what it would be like to grow up, what country you're going to go into. So I stand in front of you today, not just as a personal accomplishment, but to be a voice and to be an example of all the refugee kids that exist all around the world that are doing whatever they can to build a better future for themselves. And that we have stories, and that we have our own personal lives and dreams and accomplishments that we're so passionate about. And all we want is for you to listen, to understand, and to do what you can to help, and to offer that support that they may not have been given. And once again, I thank you all for being here and for listening to this story. And just remember to always be grateful for the things that are around you, and that refugees are absolutely capable, and we just need that little amount of support. So thank you.
Thank you to Public Affairs Department Work Study William for recording that talk. You can find out more about Mosaic Settlement and Employment Services for Newcomers at mosaicbc.org. I'll be right back. In the meantime, this is Radio Halo by Chimeras. Welcome back to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio at Simon Fraser University. I'm Jesse. We are just over halfway through the show. And now I'm going to play you an interview conducted by PA Department Work Study William with Noel from SFPIRG, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. Just giving you a little bit more information on their programs and what they're all about. So we will hear that now. Welcome back here on... Oops, that's the wrong part. I'll actually play the first part. That seems like probably the right thing to do. Here we go.
All right, hey, this is William Hofsink with CJSF Speak Up, and today I am with Noel of SFUPIRG. Noel, can you give me a little bit of a brief overview?
Hi, my name is Noel. I work at the SFPIRG, which is the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group. I'm there as the Director of Engagement, and I'm super excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, excellent. So, Noel, tell me a little bit about yourself. What really like got you engaged in public interest and social justice in general? Because I know it's a very different story for everybody.
Yeah, I think for me, I feel like I've always been kind of a person who likes to... do political sort of work. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until like college where I really met other folks that were doing that sort of work in a way that made sense to me.
Right.
I went to a university in the United States, and there was just a really rich tradition of sort of Black radical organizing there. So I sort of took a lot of my like thinking and practice from that time. And yeah, that's sort of what got me into doing like public interest and also just like political organizing in general.
You told me you were at Brown for a couple of semesters. Like, how do you think the experience at like an Ivy League school in the U.S. differs from back in Canada? Like, do you think there was a huge cultural shift and like a way that in which activism is portrayed? If I'm making sense?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways there isn't really differences. I think there's like a lot that is like with a lot of different universities, like they offer the same things, but there is this sort of image of prestige and this image of a kind of like unique type of learning that I don't think is I guess just like in the same ways that you have like classes filled with like hundreds of people here that like don't maybe like have the most resources or you know, folks don't get a ton of time with professors and things, like those problems sort of like translate across. I think the difference the biggest differences have to do with like people's access to resources after they graduate and even during their time there. I think that, you know, a lot of people, there are a lot of like communities that, what's the best way to put this? I guess just that like a lot of the ties that people form at, I think, like Ivy Leagues or just like elite institutions in general, you often have people in industry, people who are, you know, working in other like parts of the economy that will gravitate to hiring those people and gravitate to bringing those people on into their sort of parts of the division of labor. And I think what that means is that a lot of folks that go to these kinds of schools have advantages when they're going on the job market. But outside of that, it's not like you get like any kind of like special like new niche knowledge or anything like that. You're gonna like study calc here, you're gonna study calc there, it's gonna be like the same education. But yeah, so I think the advantages on the job market are really the big difference, and I think a lot of that has to do also with like nepotism and these things that are like endemic at these places. So
daddy donated a building.
Yeah, daddy donated a building, and now I get to come to class whenever I want and never do assignments and all the nine. Those are the differences, I think, that come to mind.
Yeah, so I know that there's a huge work study program at SFU. I know I'm actually part of it because of my financial situation. But do you think that there's a lot of draw to people who might be in a similar situation that I am to public interest groups, or do you think there's a way you can like maybe expand the net there? Because I don't know. Like I think that there's a lot of great opportunities to be had in public interest research, not just for people who are already interested, but like, how do you think you can get more people engaged?
Well, one of the things that we're doing right now, I'll say, we're sort of working on a new project that feels exciting to sort of bring people on to our like work study and volunteering and just into the perg in general. I will say one of the things that we're doing right now that and have been doing for a little while that is through the work study is the LFTI program, or the Letters for the Inside.
Tell me a little about that.
So that program is basically a program where folks that are incarcerated make different kinds of like research and information requests to folks on the outside, and then we sort of like craft responses to try and share as much like knowledge and information across these sort of like prison walls that are not very porous when it comes to information and knowledge that is like allowed to move. And so to sort of undermine that control that the state has over what people can know and access in prison, we sort of do these sort of research requests and engage in these sort of pen pally kind of relationships.
Like, it almost makes me wonder too about kind of recidivism being a bit of like a closed circuit too, because with that lack of information spent and the time spent within the walls of prison, do you think it might make it even harder for someone to readjust into civilian life and maybe find themselves in more criminogenic environments, criminogenic situations?
I think that, to me, I think that would be one of, like, many things that, like, make, like, a recidivism happen. Like, I think that definitely, like, folks... like access to information could be a part of that. I think in general, just people's like connectedness to other humans, like so much of, I think like what the prison tries to do is really just isolate people, and sort of make them feel very, very alone. Or at least that's how I understand it, not having actually been, inside myself. And so I think that, yeah, cutting people off from information and knowledge is one part of that. But I think that there's so many, different forces at work that produce recidivism as a kind of phenomenon, and this revolving door that is the prison, where folks exit and then come back in.
I totally understand there. Like, it almost feels counterintuitive when you're denying someone who wants to improve, wants to make up for their crimes, no matter like how horrifying, or portrayed as horrifying, because obviously like we don't know the full story. Then they want the information to be able to turn over a new leaf, and yet they just don't get that. And speaking of like information too, I can tell that the PERG has like this incredible collection of literature and of artwork as well. Can you tell me a little bit about some of like the highlights you've been reading or you would recommend? Because there's a book club too.
Ooh, oh my goodness. Sort of also connected to our new work study project, or one of an emerging one, which is our like People's University project, a sort of program for political education. And so we're doing some study groups and some teach-ins through that. One of the books that is going to be a sort of study group for us is going to be How Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Walter Rodney, which I would highly recommend to anyone. It's a sort of work on underdevelopment in Africa and sort of political economy in general. It's really, really fantastic, and sort of like argues, I think in a lot of ways, tries to demonstrate the need for like Africa to break from the sort of like international capitalist system. So that is a really cool book. One that I've been reading lately, that I finished recently, was The Caliban and the Witch, which was a really good book.
I caught you reading that on the bus too. Yeah.
No way. I've definitely read it quite a bit on the bus. Yeah.
Can you tell me a little about that too? Because from my understanding, it's like kind of taking a Marxist feminist perspective on the economy throughout history, or?
Yeah, exactly. It sort of attempts to revisit primitive accumulation in Marx's works, which is like sort of this time or this sort of idea that is all about like capitalism coming into being, like what accumulation has to happen in order for capitalism to start to stand on its own legs. And so often people think of like colonialism, people think of enslavement, but one of the sort of examples, the historical examples that Sylvia Federici kind of goes to is the witch hunts. And the witch hunts as an example or a sign of kind of primitive accumulation and the role that the witch hunts had in sort of alienating women and femme people and folks in general from their own bodies.
Yes.
And their ability to sort of assert their own agency in the sort of human reproductive process, right? Because what she sort of argues is that in the sort of entire scheme of things, right, we think of Marx is really interested in production. He's really interested in like how we make things and all this kind of stuff. And a big part of that, like one of the commodities that gets made, and he sort of calls a commodity himself, is labor power, right? Our literal life being, the thing that we all have, the ability to like kind of work in labor. And she sort of points out that it's sort of women I guess you could say like just like folks who are engaged in a certain kind of reproductive labor that actually produce labor power. And so we've kind of not really explored that idea enough, and she
the specific role of like the feminine in the means of production, like
sort of understanding, I think, like, the body as a part of the means of production.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Right? And the ways that the capitalist class, right? One of the examples she gives, which is really cool, is that, you know, in the sort of, like, late feudal period, the sort of end of the Middle Ages, you have the Black Death, which kills, like, a bunch of people. And, like, a third of Europe's population. And so this creates, like, a situation that's actually really good for wage workers because there's, like, less competition in the labor market. And so that means that they can sort of, have higher wages or push for higher wages in a way that is difficult for the capitalist class. And so what she sort of argues is that the capitalist class, in concert or in tandem with, you know, the feudal nobility and these sort of other interests, they actually go to huge extents to prevent, or rather to encourage or force women to reproduce so that they can actually increase the population and sort of like dampen the sort of win that workers had in a certain sense when there was a lower population. And so we see sort of like all kinds of stigma associated with like non-procreative sex come at this time, right?
Especially with the impact of the church too. Tying back to the witch hunt. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Carry on.
No. 1000%. Right. We see like stigma against homosexuality. We also see like the sort of criminalization of all kinds of like contraceptive activity, right? Which are sort of like tied to what folks understand as witches. So many different things. We see the introduction, or the removal of midwives from the birthing process, and sort of male doctors being responsible for the birthing process, and these sort of like demographic statistics beginning to like be taken and emerge to account for the population increases and all these things. So, sorry, that was me going off on
it.
No,
that was amazing.
We'll be right back with the second half of William and Noelle's conversation here on CJSF.
I'm Javin, and I play keyboards and sing in Young Pacific.
I'm Nathaniel. I play guitar and sing in Dead Soft.
Since moving to BC, I've been a huge fan of Emily Carr's art.
I wrote a lot of it on the road. That was our first real tour.
What role do you think time plays in transforming something into art?
We've arrived at sexual maturity as a band.
The Arts Show, every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
here on CJSF. Now pleased to bring you the second half of William's interview with Noel from the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group.
I think like one of the beautiful things about the Purg, especially when I first like engaged myself with the material and especially like the literature, there's so many different marginalized perspectives you can draw from. Like there you had those books of W.E.B. Du Bois, and you had a lot of great LGBT authors, but I still see I still see a lot of division in marginalized groups, like. Who gets to speak? Like, there are a lot of anti-transgender activists who identify as LGBT, even in this book I've been reading, ML Ferris's My Favorite Thing Is Monsters, there's an incredible scene, it's heartbreaking, in the first book where the main character's best friend, they are accosted it's set in the 1960s, they're accosted on a bus by a fellow black man, and at the time this person identifies as a black man, but they later go on to identify as a transgender woman, and they get accosted with all these like slurs, and like they're even told straight up, like following the death of MLK, like this their kind is not for civil rights. And it's just an honestly heartbreaking scene to see so much division in a time when like unity is needed the most. And obviously like we've progressed a lot in accepting transgender folks and LGBT folks, people of like not like non-traditional religious backgrounds too, but do you think there's a way that we can even improve like unity among the marginalized even more so?
Absolutely. I think that you know, one of the things that makes me think of is also the ways that we're watching like a kind of like reversal of like the sort of like move toward acceptance, and this sort of like this world where, you know, queer and trans folks have become increasingly safe. I think when we look to the United States, when we look to the bathroom bills, when we look to all of these sorts of like kinds of like legislation that criminalize like drag, and we see these like also forms of legislation starting to emerge in like conservative parts of this country, or through different kinds of like conservative parties being introduced to the legislatures. I think that there's so much to be done. And I think that, I think there's lots of ways that that can look, but I think a big part of that will just, I think, be one, like, building people's like political consciousness and growing people's political consciousness all the time, which you know, people are doing, and there's lots of people working on that. But the more, the merrier. And I also think you know, really defending queer and trans folks' rights, and understanding that a lot of the things that queer and trans folks need and deserve and are fighting for, things that we all kind of need and deserve and are fighting for. Like, I think about, you know, you talked about, like, radical activists that, you know, are anti-trans, but maybe call themselves LGB. I think about the ways that, you know, trans folks kind of struggle for body sovereignty. It feels very similar to the struggle of folks with vaginas to, you know, sovereignty over their own bodies when it comes to sort of like reproductive rights and these kinds of things. So I think there's so many ways that, you know, we're really all on the same team, like, or we're all like kind of asking for the same stuff. So I hope that those things become like bases for unity and sort of points that we can align on, and places where bridges can be built.
I agree completely. Like, I know my experience is a bit different, but as a person with a disability, right, I see a lot of infighting too on that front, whether it be from people with physical versus invisible disabilities, or even just other marginalized groups, or even like companies that put up a face to say that they're all for inclusion, but then when it actually comes to down to the complexities of integrating more accessible work environments, whether that be on the basis of race, on the basis of sexuality, on the basis of ability, they just balk under it because it's too much of a a cost. But what people don't see is like when you take the time to accommodate other people, the accommodations improve the quality of whether it be a pedagogy, whether it be employment, just for production for everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, so I think, yeah, you couldn't have said it any better. Okay, I think we've gone and covered quite a lot of ground. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the air. Is there any like closing statements you'd like to make, like plug your socials or the Perg in general?
Yeah, you can find us on Instagram at SFPerg, just SFPIRG. We're also on Facebook. We have a website. And sort of coming up for us, the LFTI program, or the Letters for the Inside, we do, or are having rather, a little volunteer day, an onboarding session that's going to be happening on June 24th from 2 to 4:30. So come by for that. And yeah, just stay in tune, stay in touch, follow us so you can know what we're doing next. And we can't wait to see you.
Woo! All right, that was Noelle with William on CJSF Speak Out. Tune in next time. Adios.
Thanks to William and Noelle for that interview. And that's about it for the show. I'm going to leave you with something a little heavy. So strap in, enjoy this, and then enjoy Democracy Now. See you next week. Oh yeah, this is Mother Buzzer by Gadfly.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.